House come to order. The members, please register their presence by voting. Does any member fail to register their presence? Clerk may take the quorum.
Thirty-three present, seven absent.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, Representatives Helen Byrne, Cotton, and Kelly are excused from the call today, although I notice Representative Cotton is present. I'll move and ask unanimous consent that any other absent members be shown as excused on official state business.
Without objection, so ordered. Membership, please rise for prayer by Reverend Alfred Wakefield, United Presbyterian Church.
May we bow our heads in prayer. Dear Lord, magnify your spirit of love, compassion, and understanding through the members of this legislative body today. May they be filled with a spirit of peace and assurance in their labors as they look to you for wisdom and guidance. Give to them the strength necessary for the performance of all of their duties, and may their lives be examples of integrity, confidence, and reliability as they express a strong faith. We thank thee that through Jesus Christ we all can experience the true experience of love and be a recipient of his gift of life that can and always be abundant. May we accept this gift and faithfully use it for the purpose and in the manner in which it is given. Thank you for hearing this prayer. Amen.
Mr. Parker.
Mr. Speaker, I ask the prayer be spread on the
without objection, the prayer was spread upon the journal. The clerk certified to the correctness of the previous day's journal.
As chief clerk, I certify as to the correctness of the journal for the 53rd day with the following correction. Page 495, line 18, insert second between the words A and conference. There's a correction for the 51st day of the journal as follows. Page 457, line 31, delete finance committee, insert rules committee for placement on the calendar.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that this body approve the journal as certified and corrected by the chief clerk for the 53rd day, and that we also approve the corrections for the corrections on the 51st day. I'll ask unanimous consent.
Without objection, so ordered. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, with your permission, I'd like to make several announcements at this time because later on today, I think there may be some confusion because of the joint session. I've been asked to announce that financial disclosure forms are available in the chief clerk's office along with instruction sets. Reminder, Mr. Speaker, that the Alaska Coastal Management program will be shown Friday, that's today at 3 p.m. in the Supreme Court room. That's two films, Ketchumak Bay, A Problem of Progress, and Uncertain Summer. Those are about 28-minute films. And a final reminder, Mr. Speaker, of the Alaska Library Association conversation and sherry wine party Sunday night, March 7th, at the Alaska State Museum.
This brings us to introduction of guests. Are there guests to be introduced to the House? Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Evan Gallery B. from Fairbanks and Dr. Sharon Murray, who is the director of the Alaska Crippled Children and Adult Speech and Hearing Center.
Chair would also like to introduce a couple of young ladies in Gallery B, one which will be a 1978 voter, and the other which is going to have to wait a while. It's my oldest daughter, Michelle, and my second oldest, Bonnie. Mr. Parker.
Mr. Speaker, also in Gallery B is a friend of many of ours who remember from the famous introduction last year, had the good sense to move from Kenai to Anchorage, Mr. Len McLean.
Other guests for introduction. Clerk, have messages from the governor.
I have signed the following resolution and am transmitting the enrolled and engrossed copy to the Lieutenant Governor's office for permanent filing. House Joint Resolution Number 51, amended by the Senate. Sincerely, signed J.S. Hammond, Governor. I have no further messages from the governor, Mr. Speaker.
Clerk, have messages from the other house.
The Senate has passed committee substitute for House Bill number 143 relating to the regulation of post-secondary educational institutions with an effective date with the following amendment. This has been duplicated and placed on every member's desk.
Speaker, may we get ease?
House will stand at ease. House, come back to order. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, I'm advised that this amendment is purely technical and has absolutely nothing to do with the substance of the bill itself, so I'll move and ask unanimous consent at this time that the House concur in the Senate version of committee substitute for House Bill number 143.
Hearing no objection, House has concurred in the Senate amendments to Senate Bill number 143. Clerk, have other messages from the Senate?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Does the clerk have general communications?
Dear Representative Bradner, the Capitol Site Selection Committee requests that it be allowed to present its findings on Capitol sites to a joint session of the Alaska State Legislature on Thursday, March 11, 1976. The purpose of the presentation is to review for the legislature the physical and economic data on each of the three sites, as well as present a series of recommendations on the issues involved in master planning once the site is selected. We look forward to your reply. Very truly yours for the committee. Signed, Leonard D. Lane, Executive Director.
Have conferred with the Senate, and the initiative is somewhat of a difficult thing, of course, for the legislature to deal with, having been a product of the initiative process by the people. And we've concluded that a joint session would perhaps be the best possible forum for these people to present their findings to us in. And that would give everybody also the opportunity to ask questions, pro or con, of that particular group of people. So we are tentatively planning a joint session. Does the clerk have other messages?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Reports of standing committees.
The Committee on Commerce is at Senate Bill 594, providing for insurance which is unavailable on the voluntary market, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee reports it back without recommendation. The report was signed by Mr. Bradley, Chairman. Having no recommendation, Freeman, Fisher, Bradley, Urien, and Rudd. Wallace signed, do pass. Senate Bill 594 has a further referral to Judiciary. The Committee on Finance is at House Bill 410 relating to the sale of oil or gas obtained by the state as a royalty, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 410 with the same title, and that it do pass. Report was signed by Mr. Malone, Chairman, concurred in by Duncan, Itta, Naughton, Guy, Haugen, Greening, and Cooper. House Bill 410 has no further referral. The Committee on Resources has had House Bill 573, extending the term of the Bristol Bay Regional Development Council, under consideration a second time. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 573 with the same title, and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Anderson, Chairman, concurred in by Anderson, Rode, Huntington, Brown, and Osterbach. Having no recommendation, Hershberger. House Bill 573 has no further referral. The Committee on Finance has had House Bill 743, making a special appropriation to the Department of Public Works, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 743 with a new title, and that it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Malone, Chairman, concurred in by Malone, Cooper, Greening, Haugen, Itta, and Duncan. Signing do not pass, Guy and Naughton. House Bill 743 has no further referral. The Select Committee on Education has had House Bill 749, making a special appropriation to the Department of Education for community schools, under consideration. Four of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Parr, Chairman, concurred in by Osterbach, Davis, Parr, and Ostrowski. Having no recommendation, Hackney and Swanson. House Bill 749 has a further referral to Finance. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Bill 774, providing for cost of living pay differentials for magistrates, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred in by Gardner, Parr, Eliason, and Brown. House Bill 774 has a further referral to Finance. The Committee on Health, Education, and Social Services has had House Bill 786 relating to faculty smoking areas in public schools, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Osterbach, Vice Chairman, concurred in by Swanson, Parr, Ostrowski, Osterbach, and Sullivan. House Bill 786 has a further referral to Judiciary. The Committee on Community and Regional Affairs has had House Bill 805 relating to senior citizen housing development grants under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it be replaced with, recommends it do pass with attached amendments. Report was signed by Mr. Cotton, Chairman, concurred in by Cotton, Kelly, Hackney, Rudd, Ostrowski, and Davis. House Bill 805 has a further referral to Finance. The Committee on Community and Regional Affairs has had House Bill 806, GO bonds in the amount of $6 million for the purpose of paying the cost of grants for construction and development of senior citizen housing, under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Cotton, Chairman, concurred in by Cotton, Kelly, Hackney, Rudd, Ostrowski, and Davis. House Bill 806 has a further referral to Finance. The Committee on Health, Education, and Social Services has had House Bill 824 relating to licensing of nurseries for children under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass with attached amendments. Report was signed by Mr. Osterbach, Vice Chairman, and concurred in by Ostrowski, Parr, Swanson, and Osterbach. Having no recommendation, Sullivan. House Bill 824 has no further referral. The Committee on Commerce has had House Bill 827 relating to landlord-tenant relations under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass with attached amendments. The report was signed by Mr. Bradley, Chairman, signing do pass Bradley, McKinnon, and Rudd. Signing do not pass Rode, Fisher, Urien, and Freeman. Having no recommendation, Wallace. House Bill 827 has no further referral. The Committee on Commerce has had House Bill 828 relating to landlord-tenant relations and amending Rules 4B, 77, and 85, Rules of Civil Procedure, under consideration. Four of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Bradley, Chairman, concurred in by McKinnon, Wallace, Rudd, and Bradley. Having no recommendation, Freeman, Urien, and Fisher. House Bill 828 has a further referral to Judiciary. I have no further committee reports, Mr. Speaker.
Clerk have reports of special committees.
No, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction of resolutions.
House Joint Resolution Number 59 by the State Affairs Committee relating to flooding on the Little Willow Creek.
State Affairs.
I have no further resolutions for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Introduction of House Bills.
House Bill Number 853 by the Judiciary Committee, enacting a nonprofit residential utility consumer action group corporation and changing Rule 24, Rules of Civil Procedure.
Judiciary.
House Bill Number 854 with a transmittal letter by the Rules Committee by request of the Governor, an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Natural Resources to acquire the leasehold interest in Kachemak Bay oil and gas leases and providing for an effective date.
Resources and Finance.
House Bill Number 855 by the State Affairs Committee, an act relating to the financial disclosure law and providing for an effective date.
State Affairs and Judiciary.
I have no further bills for introduction, Mr. Speaker.
Brings us to the daily calendar. Will the clerk read the first item on the calendar?
Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 86 by all members of the Senate, honoring George Atla for winning his sixth Spur Rendezvous Championship. I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Senate Concurrent Resolution 86 is before you for discussion. Is there any discussion?
Question.
The question is, shall Senate Concurrent Resolution 86 pass the House? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Let the record show the resolution passed unanimously.
Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 87 by all members of the Senate, honoring Roxy Brooks for her fourth consecutive victory in the Women's World Sled Dog Race.
Senate Concurrent Resolution 87 is before you for discussion and debate.
Question.
Any discussion? Question is, shall Senate Concurrent Resolution 87 pass the House? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Let the record show that the resolution passed unanimously. Clerk, read the next item on the calendar.
Sponsor substitute for House Bill Number 399 by Eliason, H. Byrne, Duncan, Hirschberger, Naughton, Ostrowski, Parker, Rode, Smith, and Sullivan. An act creating the School Activities Association within the Department of Education and providing for an effective date. The Committee on Finance has had sponsor substitute for House Bill 399 under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Malone, chairman, concurred in by Cooper, Greening, Haugen, Guy, Duncan, Buchholz, and Malone. I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Speaker, in the absence of amendments, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill 399 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Hearing no objection, the sponsor substitute for House Bill 399 is advanced on second and third reading, placed on final passage. Will the clerk read the bill for the third and final time?
Sponsor substitute for House Bill number 399 by Eliason et al. An act creating the School Activities Association within the Department of Education and providing for an effective date.
House Bill 399 is before you for discussion and debate. Mr. Eliason.
Mr. Speaker, the Alaska High School Activities Association was organized in 1956 as a voluntary nonprofit association. It is a statewide organization which has been delegated authority to manage and control interscholastic activities by member schools. Since that time, Mr. Speaker, at that particular time, they're interested only in basketball, a track and music festivals in the Western Division. Now, there were with about 1,750 students participating, but we find ourselves in 1975 with they've greatly expanded the program to some 20 different activities now, including girls basketball, badminton, music festivals, and so on, with over 14,000 students participating. And this, Mr. Speaker, has been on a voluntary basis, the management of this program through the member schools, but it's grown to the point now where it takes up a great deal of time of these people who are managing the program when they should be attending to the educational functions they're hired for. So they're requesting that we set up in the Department of Education an executive director of this association who will be funded through the state legislature and also through the activities of this association. We're talking about 61 different high schools throughout Alaska, all the way from Craig to Barrel. Mr. Speaker, this bill, the physical note is $100,000. Of this amount, through the dues and through the tournament fees, the officials' fees, and sale of rule books, $40,000 will be netted from these proceeds, which leaves an actual expense item of $60,000 to run the program, which would allow for an executive director, would allow for a clerk, and the supplies and miscellaneous things of that nature. Mr. Speaker, I did receive a communication which was unsolicited yesterday from a principal in my school district who said that the letter says that Region 5 Southeastern Alaska High Schools have recently completed a spring business meeting at Sitka and once again have pointed out the need for funding a full-time executive director. One section of the state is not able to be aware of what another section of the state is doing. Therefore, the Board of Control, the governing body of the Alaska High School Activities Association, cannot control the activities of high schools effectively. There definitely is a need for an office to centralize all activities of the association and know what is going on. And he urges me to support my bill. Thank you.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Eliason anticipated most of my comments. I guess all I'll say is just wanted to point out that occasionally members of the oldest political party in the United States also ask questions of the second oldest political party in the United States as to how much their programs will cost, but Mr. Eliason did answer my question.
Any other discussion? Question is, shall House Bill 399 pass the House? The members may proceed to vote. Any member failed to vote, clerk may close the roll. Member wish to change their vote, clerk might take the roll.
Thirty-six yeas, no nays, four excused.
Clerk, read the next item on the calendar.
There is an effective.
Mr. Miller.
Move and ask unanimous consent that the roll call on Senate or on House Bill 399 be considered the roll call on the effective date clause.
Without objection, so ordered.
House Bill number 572 by McKinnon, an act relating to the disclosure of geographical distribution of loans. The Committee on Commerce has had House Bill 572 under consideration. The members of the committee recommend it be replaced with committee substitute for House Bill 572 with the same title but adding an effective date, and that it be reported back with individual recommendations. The report was signed by Mr. Bradley, Chairman, signing DuPass, Rudd, McKinnon, and Bradley. Having no recommendation, Kelly. Signing do not pass, Fisher, Freeman, and Urien. I have one committee substitute on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that the committee substitute be accepted in lieu of the original bill.
There be no objection. Committee substitute is adopted. Does the clerk have amendments?
No, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that Commerce Committee substitute for House Bill 572 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on the final passage.
There be no objection. The committee substitute for House Bill 572 is advanced from second to third reading, placed on final passage. Will the clerk read the bill for the third and final time?
Committee substitute for House Bill number 572 by the Commerce Committee. An act relating to the disclosure of geographical distribution of loans and providing for an effective date.
Bills before you for discussion and debate. Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Speaker, this bill is intended to deal with a banking practice known as redlining. That's the deliberate policy of a financial institution of cutting off mortgages and home improvement loans to particular areas. In effect, these banks and savings and loans have written off certain neighborhoods. And this is done with no consideration for the creditworthiness of the individual who's making the application for the loan. For an arbitrary reason, banks decide that certain neighborhoods, regardless of the financial condition of the people living in them, are no longer going to get home improvement money. And this comes in two stages. The first is a more gradual type of condition where loans are just made harder to get. People in certain areas have to pay higher interest rates. They have to put down substantially larger down payments, or the terms of the loans are shortened so that instead of getting a 30-year mortgage, you get a 20 or a 15-year mortgage. And what this does is inevitably contribute to the decline of the neighborhood, since people can't get improvement loans to maintain their residences, since new people aren't being attracted to the neighborhood. People have to sell out at considerably lower prices, dropping property values, and generally it's inevitable that the neighborhood is going to decay. What this bill does is tie into a recently passed federal law called the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act of 1975. That bill requires financial institutions to disclose certain information about loans geographically. One problem with the bill, which this bill is intended to improve, or one problem with the federal act that this bill is intended to remedy, is that like many other acts, it doesn't quite fit Alaska. And that's that banks, to a certain degree, will have the option of reporting by zip code or census tract. The problem, I've passed out a map which members can take a look at, and perhaps with a degree of bias, I've included my district in the map. But those of you who are familiar with Anchorage will note that the heavy black line defines the 99503 zip code. Within that zip code are areas such as Turnagain, Spinard, and Windermere. I think those of you who are familiar with Anchorage realize that those are three entirely different types of neighborhoods, and that bank lending policies towards the three would be considerably different. Within that zip code area, you'll note certain smaller defined areas with numbers in them. And those are the census tracts for those areas. Census tracts 13, 14, 19, 20, 21, 22, and 24. Now, under the state bill, the banks would be required to report by those smaller census tracts to give more relevant information. In areas outside Alaska, often in very large cities, zip code areas do define neighborhoods. But here in Alaska, they don't. For instance, the 504 zip code in Anchorage, I believe, includes Mountain View and College Village and other areas that aren't quite, as far as socioeconomic characteristics go, equal. So So that's the basic intent of the bill, is to piggyback on the federal bill and guarantee that reporting will be by census tract. In addition, it requires certain additional information, which are intended to get at some of the preliminary stages of redlining, and that's information on the terms of loan and the interest rates, which are not now required under the federal law. It also would require a breakdown, which is not required under federal law, as to how much money banks or the types of loans banks are making inside and outside the state. So I think it would be of interest to Alaskans to find out if with the tight housing conditions here, banks are loaning outside the state. The main objection raised in committee was the additional cost to the financial institutions. But as I said, this piggybacks onto a federal law, so that the costs are already there. The federal government is requiring this information to be disclosed, and the banks have the preliminary startup costs, and they also have the annual reporting costs. I've talked with several people who are familiar with computer operations. They say that the annual cost will be virtually no different. There'll be an additional printout for national banks who will be required to disclose, but it's extremely likely that state banks will be exempted from the provisions of the federal requirements, because we would have a much stricter law with this law in the books. The only appreciable different cost will be the initial startup cost and the expense involved in setting up the computer program. Since there would be different reporting requirements, there'd have to be adjustments made in the computer program. There was testimony that since this is the federal law is a nationwide law, there'll be national computer companies coming up with prepackaged programs that banks can simply buy. And the argument was that it would be substantially cheaper than going out and creating your own new program. As I said, I've talked with local computer people, and they've indicated that those savings aren't really substantial, that in all probability a program that would allow a bank to comply with both the state and the federal law at the same time with just simply two printouts can be prepared, and that at no appreciable additional cost. The estimates on the federal law are that the annual reporting costs, and these estimates were prepared by the American Bankers Association, which is a trade organization for the bankers, indicates that the cost will be $180 per year after the startup year. And the indications I've gotten from the computer people here are that the additional cost would be virtually negligible, that the only real difference in cost is going to be that startup cost, and it's not going to be substantial at all. California already requires extremely detailed reporting by census tracts, although it's not intended as redlining disclosure information. It is fairly detailed, and their costs are not substantially higher than the federal government's cost under the New Disclosure Act. So I think the only real argument is cost, and that the costs engendered by this bill are not substantially higher than the costs the banks are already going to have. I do think that the people have a right to know if banks have written off their neighborhoods, and so that perhaps there can be some sort of a state program or that they have some sort of remedy to try to get money into their areas. I think people have a right to know that information. And that's the intent of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, a brief remark or two. And one is that I think that I find some of the remarks made by previous speaker more offensive than I do the idea that it's contained inside the bill. And the thing that I find offensive is that I detect some sort of an idealism that indicates that perhaps mortgage banking should become a social welfare program. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Urien.
Mr. Speaker, I was wondering if the sponsor of the bill can tell us what would happen to a financial institution if at the end of the year its report showed that it didn't make some loans in certain census tracts. And does this report have any relationship, show any relationship between the amount of loans applied for and loans made, or is it just loans made?
Kennan.
Mr. Speaker, absolutely nothing would happen to a bank that is practicing redlining. All this bill is intended to do is let people know if their neighborhoods have been singled out for a lack of capital so that they can seek some other remedy. This is no attempt whatsoever to force banks to make loans where they don't want to. The thing is simply to find out which neighborhoods. I think it's a valid, the state has a valid interest in finding out which neighborhoods have been written off by private enterprise so that perhaps some sort of state program can be created to take care of it. I've forgotten the second portion of Mr. Urien's question. Could you repeat it?
Mr. Urien.
Is there a relationship, does this report show a relationship between loans applied for and loans granted? Because you could come up and say that there were no loans made in a certain census tract when in fact there was never anyone, no one ever applied for a loan in that tract.
I considered the problem, and I talked with Dick Hall from MBA about it. And his indication was that they didn't want to, it would be impractical to provide this information simply because there was no real definition of what an application is. Very few people get to the stage of filling out an application if they're not going to get the loan. People call on the phone and perhaps talk to a loan officer, and the loan officer can, you know, give them pretty much an indication about whether or not it'd be seriously considered for the loan. And therefore, does that count as an application or doesn't it? It's not really a formal application. So that was a reason that I didn't attempt to have applications included in the bill.
Mr. Chioian.
Mr. Speaker, I think Mr. McKinnon's comments have pointed out that a total that this bill is totally unnecessary. He has assumed that there is a problem in a practice called redline. He's assumed that. And then he comes up with a bill that if there is the problem, it doesn't correct the problem. All it does is cause additional paperwork by the financial institutions of the state of Alaska. And to put this out to the public that we've solved some sort of a problem, and actually all we're doing is creating a problem.
Mr. McKinnon.
Mr. Speaker, I haven't assumed that the problem exists. The Congress of the United States has assumed that it exists. Bankers came before the Congress and testified that this just doesn't happen. But there are redlining laws in other areas. Cook County in Illinois had one for several years. Then the state of Illinois adopted a redlining ordinance. Baltimore has one. I believe Washington, D.C. just passed one. And in every instance, banks have just come in and said, we just don't do that. We, you know, make our loans based on the individual creditworthiness of the applicant. We don't redline. And yet, these laws have proved that, in fact, financial institutions do redline. And Congress, I think when the bill was considered by the Congress, in the committee reports on it, in both the majority committee report and in the dissenting views, everybody acknowledged that this practice goes on, and that it does take place. So this is just to find out if it is happening in Alaska, and to make sure that a federal law, which might not indicate that, will be tailored so that it does provide that information for Alaska. In addition, it's not a great deal of paperwork. The banks are already going to have to comply with federal law. This means just an additional box or space or two on the form where they're going to have to fill in the term of the loan and the interest rate. And that's information that they already maintain in their computer files. So that they already provide that information on the paperwork that goes into the computer. So that it's not really, the only additional paperwork is going to be the extra printout that will have to be maintained for the state.
Mr. Bradley.
Mr. Speaker, hearing testimony in committee and hearing testimony on the floor, I'm even more convinced that this bill is germane not only to the cities but to rural Alaska. So I like it even better.
Mr. Brown.
Mr. Speaker, on a different issue relating to the bill, I was not familiar with the bill except just having seen it a while back. I'm not on the committee that considered it, and the only concern I had, I think, has been taken care of in an informal conversation, or at least a question and a questioning look back and forth with the sponsor here. And I'd just like to state for the record that it appears to me that while someone might be concerned that the matters being reported here could invade privacy, I was just looking over the bill and very carefully thinking about all the situations. That would have been my major question on the bill. But as I see the bill, I see that all those matters that are disclosed are either matters that are just averaged over many or several loans, or on the other hand, are matters which are required to be for enforceability purposes, and in fact, as a matter of banking practice, are recorded as public documents in the various recorders' districts within Alaska. So I don't think there's any problem of that sort, and when I first looked at the bill, that was the only problem I saw. I had heard of the practice of redlining before. I think the bill is a good one, and I'm going to vote for it.
We do have a... Mrs. Fisher, could I recognize Mr. Miller this time? We do have a problem with the joint session coming up. Mr. Miller.
Mr. Speaker, if we could wrap this up in about 1 minute. I don't want to cut anybody off, but if we're going to have very much more debate, we should perhaps recess. Maybe we could have an indication of how many members would like to speak.
I think we've got considerable members who would like to debate the bills.
Yeah, I think so too, Mr. Speaker. So I'll move and ask unanimous consent that this body stand in recess until 11 o'clock. Please do not leave the area.
Without objection, we're in recess.
Leave the area.
Joint session come to order. Provision of our joint rules, the Senate, President, the Senate presides over our joint sessions, and it's my privilege to turn the gavel over to Senator Chancey Crop.
Senator Tulloch. Mr. President, I would move and ask unanimous consent to roll call the Senate be waived and all shown as present.
Senator Tulloch moves and ask unanimous consent to roll call the Senate be waived and all senators be shown as present. Without objection, for Representative Miller.
Mr. President, I'll move and ask unanimous consent.
Representative Miller moves and asks unanimous consent. The roll call of the House be waived. All representatives be shown as present. Without objection, so ordered. At this time, I'd appoint Senator Gratula, Representative Miller, to call on President of the Oregon Senate, Jason Bowen, and escort him to the chamber. In the meantime, joint session stand at ease. Government in Alaska, we are most efficient when we draw on the wide range of experiences and ideas available to us, not only in our own state, but in our sister states of the South. As William Fulbright warned a decade ago, it is only through vigorous competition of ideas that a consensus of values can sometimes be translated into a true consensus of policy. Of course, that was before he was defeated by Dale Bumpers when he ran for the Senate, but still seems like it. With this in mind, we have begun this year what I hope will become an annual program of inviting leaders from other states to address us of issues of mutual concern. Through this process, Alaska can be part of a vigorous competition of ideas. Of all the states, none is so closely related to us as Oregon. It was to Oregon's law that the territory of Alaska looked as a model for its own code in 1884. This, together with the great similarity of our basic resources, gives the opportunity for our two states to progress in a common alliance often ignored by other members of the Union. In the interest of continuing that alliance, I am pleased to welcome Senator Jason Bowe, President of the Oregon Senate. Now serving his second term as President of the Senate, Senator Bowe has shown strong interest in areas also of concern this year to many of our members. He has led the movement towards open government, promotion of media information programs, and legislative oversight of executive branch rulemaking powers. In the rich lore of his experience and that of his state, there is much available to assist us as we confront the issues before us this year. So it is with pleasure and anticipation that I present to you Senator Jason Bowe.
Thank you, Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, and distinguished members of the Alaska Legislature. I'm honored to be given this opportunity to share some thoughts, concepts with you today. The problems that face each of our states, in my opinion, are growing greater, and so must the machinery of state government grow to contend with the problems. I was most interested the other day in getting two newspaper clippings, both of them editorials, one from a major newspaper in the Portland metropolitan area. I happen to come from an area, a very small town, about 4,500 people, on the southern part of the Oregon coast. And so a number of members that I've met have been apologizing for their weather. The only thing different between the weather in Reedsport, Oregon, and Juneau, Alaska, is that we don't have the white stuff. But as far as the wet stuff, we get our share, and probably as much, or maybe even a little bit more than you get of that. But I received these two editorials, and the interesting thing was that they were published within just a matter of several days of each other. And the one from the Portland metropolitan area was complaining bitterly about the Senate president, who never seemed to do anything for the metropolitan areas or for the urban population in the state, and was quite bitter and vociferous in their criticism of a decision that I had made recently. At the same time, and published within just, must have been hours afterwards, came a newspaper editorial from a newspaper in my own district complaining that the president of the Senate was playing footsies with the liberals in the Portland metropolitan area and therefore was not taking good care of his own constituents at home. So my liberal friends all accuse me of being conservative, and my conservative friends all accuse me of being liberal. And so I think it probably places me exactly where I want to be, which is somewhere just to the left or just to the right of the center, which is, I think, the place where the most work is done. I've had the opportunity in the last 11 years to serve both in the House of Representatives and the Senate. As a matter of fact, at this moment, I still have more seniority in the House of Representatives than I have in the Senate. I've only been in the Senate for 5 years. I served three terms in the House. And during those terms, the Republicans happened to be in control of the House, and so I kind of came up through the chairs. My second term in the House, I was the minority whip, and my third term, I was the minority leader. And the only reason we ever got to a majority status, I believe, was because of the fact that during the 1969 session, the Republicans, rather ill-advisedly, tried to pass a sales tax down in Oregon, and we led the opposition against that sales tax. And as a matter of fact, it was defeated by a narrow margin. I think it was 10-1 against the sales tax. And so I had the opportunity to move over to the Senate in 1971. And in 1973, I was elected by my colleagues to serve as president of the Senate. So I've had that gamut of experience in both houses of the legislature, as well as the perspective of being able to see from a leadership role the minority and the operation of the majority. And believe me, it's a lot better on the majority side than it ever was on the minority side. And I do understand, I do understand the frustrations, and have moved, I hope well, to ameliorate some of the frustrations that I felt when I was a member of the minority. As a consequence, we have developed a rather good and close rapport with our colleagues of the opposite party, which I think in the state legislative process is perhaps the best way to go, rather than having the stridently partisan legislature as we see it in some of the other states of this nation. Partisanship has its good and purposeful role, but there comes a time, too, when partisanship must be submerged in the interest of moving the state forward and getting the job done. So it's indeed appropriate that I appear here today in Juneau, 6 days after a new super barge called the Oregon was christened in Portland just the other day. Within the next several weeks, this super barge Oregon will enter service and will bring our states even closer together. This is the first of a number of these type of barges that are going to be under construction in the Portland shipyards for trade with Alaska. These are going to bring our states ever closer together. I'm excited by the economic benefits that I see for both of our states in enhancing this type of trade. I was surprised the other day to read some statistics that the Port of Portland, I believe, is closer than some of the Puget Sound ports into Seattle and Tacoma in actual number of miles from some of the major ports, at least here in the state of Alaska. So it's my hope that this is going to be just the first of a number of things that will bring our two states together. We have much in common, as the President has said. And while the federal government and public domain owns a great deal of the state of Alaska, I understand in excess of 90% is federally owned. You may not know that the state of Oregon is owned 60% by federal, state, and local government. 60% of the land mass in Oregon is held in public ownership. And so we share some of your frustrations right along with the seeming inflexibility of the federal government with regard to how they're operating their lands. And I understand, incidentally, that the first trip that the Oregon is going to make, this new barge, is going to be bringing a great number of modular housing units to Alaska in some sizable quantity. I thought, if you like, I'll see what I can do to include a few modular governor's offices in that first load so that you can have this fine building all to yourselves and maybe ameliorate some of the problems that I understand that you're in with respect to the executive. Quite seriously, we are engaged in a major expansion of our Capitol building. Our Capitol burned down in 1933, 34, and was reconstructed and dedicated in 1936. So it is one of the relatively newer capitals, but at that, it's 40 years of age now. So we are in a major construction phase right now of adding wings to our state capitol building, some 150,000 square feet of additional space with a number of new and, I think, magnificent committee hearing rooms will be provided in this new building. So while I understand that you, too, have some little problem here about where your capital is going to be and if it's going to move and if it's going to move, where it's going to move, and if it does all that, how much it's going to cost. And I understand there's some controversy about whether it's $2 billion or $1 billion. It's a lot of bucks any way you look at it, because I know our building is going to run, our expansion is going to run $10 or $15 million and easily, and maybe more. So I would be happy to share any of these plans that we have for our capital with any of you that have an interest in the planning space for legislative functions. If you do go ahead and plan, and I'm certainly not going to enter into that controversy, I wasn't elected president of the Senate for nothing. If you do move your capital and plan it, and I would like to extend a warm welcome to your leadership and to anyone that they might designate to come to Oregon and take a look at what will be the newest major expansion to any state capital in the United States, which we will have in Oregon. And we would be happy to share with you the good things and point out maybe some of the things that we would do differently if we had it to do over again. I'd like to spend a few minutes with you now just outlining the legislative process in Oregon. I've had a chance to go over with the President and some of the members, some of the things that you're doing. And I want to say I'm impressed with what Alaska is doing. You're moving right, and you're moving well, and I think you're moving cautiously but vigorously into this whole area that I'm going to talk about now for the next few minutes. We have cut down, when I first assumed the presidency of the Senate, I came into a Senate that had 20 standing committees. In 1973, I cut that down. We have 30 members in our Senate, incidentally, and 60 members in our House. I cut that to 15 committees in 1973, and this year cut it to 12 committees. And for our size of Senate and the volume of work that we do, which I'll go into you a little more fully later, this I believe to be the optimum, at least for my operation. This is the optimum number of committees. We've increased the membership slightly of each of those committees from 5 to generally to 7 members, which again gives us the opportunity of getting a broader philosophical or ideological composition of the committee, as well as a better geographical composition of the committee, because geography in Oregon, like Alaska again, is very important and sometimes very crucial. We have several distinct zones. We have Southern Oregon, where I come from, we call ourselves the rebels generally. We have the coastal area, we have the Willamette Valley in Portland, and we have the mountainous ranges, and of course Eastern Oregon. All of these are vastly different sections with different stresses and different types of economy.
with respect to staffing, we now have instituted a combination of professional nonpartisan staff and professional partisan staffing. The staffs of our legislative council, and in our system, the legislative council is our team of 18 attorneys plus staff members who do our bill drafting, at times offer legal advice when we ask them. It's the staff of attorneys that handle the those particular jobs. The legislative fiscal, which works with our joint Ways and Means Committee, which is our finance committee. It is a joint committee, an operation that I happen to like very well. Found out today that one of the members, I think the Senate Chairman of Appropriations, doesn't like that idea at all. He likes it the way it is here. But I'd like to discuss sometimes, if any of you are interested in that particular operation, which I think does have a great deal of merit in it. So the Legislative Council, the Fiscal, the Legislative Revenue Office, which is a new office that we created this year, where before we used to have to depend almost solely upon the information that we would get from the executive departments, the Department of Revenue of the executive. We have now developed about a seven-member legislative revenue office for research for the legislature, again, so that we no longer are dependent upon the executive and his Department of Revenue for the fiscal information that we want with respect to taxation. And we have also then our legislative research group. Now, these are all nonpartisan staff. I have personally fired three people over the last 4 years for what I considered improper partisan activities while a member and on official business of the of these nonpartisan staffs. I think if it's going to work, at least in our system, it takes that kind of toughness to make sure that you don't mix these two functions. Because in any of these things, from the council, legislative council, to the fiscal, to the revenue office, and the research, these are functions that should be open and available with complete confidentiality and with complete integrity to the members of both political parties without having to worry about somebody sandbagging you from the professional staff. The staffing for our standing committees and for our interim committees that work during the interim are also professional, but would perhaps more aptly fit the partisan label, because these are, of course, chosen basically by the chairman of these committees, who are, of course, members of the majority party. But again, we have set up some rather rigid qualifications for these positions, so that it's not the idea that somebody can go out and pick out a hack or somebody that was very influential or instrumental in getting him elected and simply put him on the state's payroll in these positions. There are professional qualifications, but they may, and most likely are, at least attuned to each other from the standpoint of partisan politics. We have staffed also then the majority and the minority office. And this is direct partisan staffing on this part, where the minority party has his administrative assistants, research people. The majority party has the same type of staff. We've been very careful and tried to be very careful to give to the minority party the same perquisites and the same advantages that we give to our own majority with respect to this. And again, I think it has helped smooth the waters many times. And again, this was a product of having gone through the system when it was being operated by the opposition party, and I didn't think it was being operated fairly. I was not getting what I thought I should have in order just to simply put up a good defense against the majority party, which is our system, our adversary system. And so I believe very strongly in the staffing adequately, both from the partisanship, but then I believe it's to our advantage not to have that same type of partisan staffing when it comes to the professional duties of the committees. During the two sessions over which I have presided, we have worked with the committee chairman to develop a very steady flow of bills to the floor, and I understand from the president that the Alaska legislature is moving well in this direction also. Particularly crucial to the scheduling, as I'm sure you all realize, is the work of our Ways and Means Committee. It's our joint finance committee. We learned from our 1973 experiences and made quantum improvements in 1975. We tied the length of the session to the work of the Ways and Means and began early in the session with several night meetings of the full Ways and Means Committee to consider priority measures and controversial measures to get them underway. This allowed the subcommittees of that committee to concentrate on a careful analysis of the budget bills and freed the full committee for consideration of the subcommittee recommendations during the last half of the session. We also have in the interim what we call our emergency board. This was a constitutional amendment that was presented to the people back in 1952 and approved overwhelmingly by them. And the emergency board serves, I suppose you'd say, as a mini legislature. Our detractors call us a mini legislature, and sometimes we are. It's composed of the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House as the co-chairman. It includes by statute the co-chairman of the finance committees and certain requisition, certain requisites for partisan balance on the committee. And these 15 people, eight from the House and seven from the Senate, have the caretaker function of the legislature while and when the legislature is not in session, to the point that, as it has developed statutorily with our constitutional mandate, there is no department of the executive branch of government in the state of Oregon that can go for a federal grant or even make application for a federal grant without first coming to the emergency board and gaining the emergency board's approval by a majority vote of that 15-member committee. This has kept us out of very great problems that I'm sure you're all aware of, that when the agencies were on their own to make application for these funds, the funds would come and perhaps it'd start out with 90% federal money and 10% state match. The next year, Congress, it was 75-25, and the next year it was 50-50, and the year after that, they eliminated the program. And meantime, the constituency within the state had developed. They wanted, needed, desired the services that were provided, and it was all back on state government to finance these. So we have saved ourselves literally billions of dollars over the period of time since 1952 with this operation. Again, if that piques your interest, I would be more than happy to send you some rather good research work that we've done by, that's been done by our research committee on just how this operates, the constitutionality of it, and I'd be happy, most happy to talk to you about this. Much of our progress was made possible by work of the interim committees, and I understand Alaska now has gone through the system of some interim committee work. I think it's excellent. The joint interim committees worked during the roughly 18-month interim period to have measures ready by the beginning of the session. More bills in 1975 were referred to committee during the first 3 days of the 1975 session than the first 2 weeks of the 1973 session. Our pre-session planning for committee staff and chairman paid off. By the end of the seventh week of the 1975 session, the Senate had acted upon 113 measures, all of which had been heard and worked on by the standing committees. This is more than double the 44 measures acted upon by the Senate during the first 7 weeks of the 1973 session. During the entire session of 153 calendar days in 1975, the Oregon legislature considered 2,449 bills and passed 805 of these bills by both houses and signed by the governor. During 1973, in a session that lasted almost 1 month longer than the 1975 session, the legislature considered 146 fewer bills and passed 51 more. I think the results demonstrate the value of pre-session planning and an active interim committee program. Also the professional staff assistance and careful attention to the number of committees and the scheduling of the workload of those committees. Incidentally, by going back and comparing 1967, we can get a real idea of the improvements that Oregon has made in the process. That session in 1967 was 4 days longer than the 1975 session, yet considered almost 1,000 fewer bills. Those figures, I think, adequately demonstrate the increased role of the legislature in today's complex government. And I'm sure you're also going to find this out, that your workload is going to increase. I understand that your bill passage is quite a bit, is around 200 bills, I think, something in that nature, 215, 225. I think if you start charting the number of bills introduced and go back, clear back to your statehood, easily enough done, you will see probably an increasing line, a steadily increasing line in the number of bills introduced. And I think that this is going to be a continuing, it has in Oregon been a very much of a continuing trend, and one that I think we're going to have to live with, although we're, I think, almost to the maximum. I don't know how they can get any more bills, but I say that every session, and more bills seem to come in spite of rather rigid introduction rules and time limits on introduction. I understand that you are presently considering measures relating to public information and access to records. You should be interested to hear that the 1973 session of our legislature introduced comprehensive public meetings and public records laws to provide for expanded citizen awareness and participation in the conduct of public's business and broadened access to the records of various public agencies. As our Court of Appeals has said, freedom of information is now by statute the rule, and secrecy is the exception. It should be obvious from the statistics that I have mentioned that guaranteeing adequate notice to press and public, opening all of our doors and most of our records, did not impair the smooth operation of our legislature during our first regular session under these new laws. Let me briefly describe each law for you. The public meetings law applied to any meeting of every state or local governmental board, commission, council, committee, or subcommittee consisting of two or more members at which there exists a quorum, and the purpose of which is to decide or deliberate on public matters. The only bodies exempted by the law are the parole board, the banking board, the Commission on Judicial Fitness, judicial proceedings and deliberations by administrative bodies acting in a judicial capacity, such as the Workmen's Compensation Board. By constitutional amendment, the legislature must conduct all of its business in open meetings. Since party caucuses do not conduct public business, they remain closed. From time to time, somebody will make a move to open one of the caucuses. I did it when I was a member of the minority party. You know, I say, hey, come on in, guys. You know, we have got nothing to hide. We didn't know what was going on anyway. And so we scored a great press coup by opening up our caucus to the press and say, yeah, come on, we don't have any secrets. You know, why won't the Republicans let you in? You know, you should be asking those questions. And they did, and the Republicans didn't open them up. And obviously now that we're in the majority, we don't open up our caucuses to the press anymore either. Governmental bodies may go into executive session for consideration of personnel matters, collective bargaining, and the like, but no formal action may be taken during such sessions. Allowing members of the press to attend executive session, subject to reasonable restrictions in reporting sensitive matters, is encouraged by the law. An important corollary to open meetings is adequate notice to the public so that they may attend the meetings. To facilitate this type of notice, all of our standing committees had regular meeting times during the session. In addition to publication of the normal notices and agendas in our daily calendar, we required committees to post their agendas in several places, distribute them to the press room, and mail them to interested parties on their mailing list. Again, pre-session planning, which I cannot emphasize enough, and capable staff made compliance relatively easy during the bulk of the session. It was not without problems. The Speaker of the House, incidentally, was sued by the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association because of a so-called secret meeting, which really wasn't. We had a very tough issue in field burning in the Willamette Valley of burning the stubble, which creates a lot of smoke and pollution. And the Speaker inadvertently got into a closed committee with a quorum of that committee. A member of the press asked to be admitted. The Speaker denied press member that particular privilege, and as a consequence, he and all the members of that committee are now in court in litigation with the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. There is a constitutional question whether or not the legislature is subject to these open meeting laws itself, I mean, whether it's constitutional to do that. So it's going to be a very interesting case, and I suppose if they get if the case goes against them, it'll be a press report that'll probably reach your major newspapers up here. As the session drew to a close this last year, we always strive for at least 24-hour notice. You all know the log jams that we get into during those closing final hours. And we utilized, instead of mail, telephone calls to keep interested citizens, agencies, and lobbyists informed. Conference committees presented a real problem. And as you might know, during the end of the session, when things are moving very quickly and the presiding officer snapped off a couple of names for a conference committee and the other presiding officer does the same thing, how do you conform with it? So we took care of that by a change in the rules of the House. And as you know, or at least in Oregon, the rules take precedence over the statutes. And we changed the rules so that in these instances, which were clearly delineated, that conference committees could meet without the 24-hour notice. And it seemed to work quite well. We kept the press and the public informed, and there was never any question about it. We were also helped in this program by another innovation that we have come up with that I would seriously recommend to you for your consideration, whether you stay here or move elsewhere, and that is what we call our Legislative Assembly Media Project. And the acronym, of course, is LAMP, L-A-M-P. LAMP is basically a closed-circuit TV system with videotape capability. Originally designed to open up hearings to larger audiences through TV monitors that are scattered about through the Capitol building, we soon added a character generator to the system, which provides a continuous display of all committee and session schedules, agendas, and special messages. The visual information can be superimposed on live coverage of a hearing without distracting from either. Another aspect of the LAMP system further enhanced our contact with the public. We made videotapes of hearings available for rebroadcast on the educational TV network and local cable systems. Thus, we were able to bring the work of the legislature into practically every home in the state. Our only regret is that only one of our hearing rooms was equipped with cameras, which, by the way, are very inconspicuous. They're bracket mounted on the wall and remotely controlled from a control room. But by some judicious juggling and scheduling, however, we were able to get almost every Senate and House committee, except Ways and Means, on camera in this room for one or more of their important hearings. In some cases, for example, the work of the Senate Agriculture Committee on this field burning issue, which I mentioned earlier, which is a highly controversial bill, almost all of this committee's work was conducted in the LAMP hearing room, and as a consequence, a tape record was made. Now, these tapes are compatible with commercial broadcast facilities, in black and white, however, not color. And it strikes me, perhaps, that Alaska might want to take a look at that, because in getting the work out to the legislature, out to the people, it seems to me that this type of tape that could be cycled or circled around through your various facilities, cable facilities, and commercial broadcast facilities in the state could bring the work of the legislature even closer than it is to the people. During the 1977 session, we hope to have our TV system installed in at least two of our six new hearing rooms that will be in this new construction that we have going on. And one of these cameras will be in the Joint Ways and Means Committee room, the Finance Committee room, which will, of course, open up further the work of this important committee to the public so that the public can see the work that goes into the forming of these budgets as they go over these budgets on a line-by-line basis. I think that a system like this media project would be of great benefit, could be of very great benefit to your state. And again, we stand ready to assist you in any way that we can, should you desire to look into it. Our open records law may be of more interest to you than open meetings, since you're currently developing your own legislation in this area. Basically, all public records of all public bodies in our state are open to inspection. Fees may be charged for copies, and reasonable rules may be adopted to ensure that providing the information does not substantially interfere with the operations of the governmental body. There are many specific exemptions, but generally they are those records which involve internal advisory communications, confidential disclosures by citizens to an agency, matters of a personal nature such as personal or medical files, matters in litigation, trade secrets, examination questions, and criminal investigatory material. Within the legislature, it means that all of a committee's records are open for public inspection. This is it should be, as legislative bodies are traditionally open, and every citizen, I believe, has a right to know what information has been considered by a committee in addition to that made public during a hearing. I'm happy to report this bill, strangely enough, worked well. While I'm aware of some of the problems with the open meetings law, particularly with some local governmental bodies that have historically and traditionally abused executive sessions, I am not aware of any complications relating to the opening of public records. It has been a boon to interested citizens, the press, researchers, and even public officials who need to know what's going on. It does make it difficult, but not impossible, to get the kind of candid, confidential information that we sometimes need to form a judgment about a particular matter. For example, what weight to give a letter of complaint from an inmate in a state institution. But in my opinion, since the exceptions to the open records law protect things which deserve to be protected, the example cited, a person's right to privacy, this inconvenience becomes justifiable. The subject of records allows me to brag a bit about another one of the innovations in the legislature in Oregon, and this is what we call the Oregon Legislative Information System, another acronym, OLIS, O-L-I-S. We are fortunate to have a small staff of computer experts who have literally pioneered the use of computers in the legislative process. Our computer program, unlike that of the state of Washington, does not provide us with sophisticated fiscal information at this time. Instead, as the name implies, it provides us with information on measure status, bill and statute text, and is keyed into the state's printer, the state printing shop, to provide us with legislative publications. During the 1975 session, the daily calendar was processed and composed by OLIS. During the interim, the system was used to publish our revised statutes. As a result, for the first time in anyone's memory, users of our statutes will receive their 1975 replacement parts and the new index at the same time and on schedule. Our experience this year was not without its difficulties, but the potential of the system is being realized, and in future years we believe we can have the revised statutes available to the users within a very short period of time after sine die, rather than the 6 to 9 months later as we did under the old manual system. We plan to compose all bills and measures, engrossment of bills, the calendars and the journals on OLIS in 1977. As a result of the publication of our revised statutes by computer, our database now includes the current text of all our statutes, as well as an index and a cross-index by topic. In other words, if somebody wants to find out a subject matter, say child abuse, a legislator is digging into child abuse and wants to know, he just types in child abuse, hits the code keys, and zip, his Oregon revised statute, every reference within the statutes pertaining to child abuse will be flashed on the screen before him. Obviously a tremendous research tool, and we're certainly looking forward to it. We have these consoles, these video consoles, located conveniently throughout the office. The presiding officers each have one in their own private offices. They're scattered around throughout the building in a manner that makes them easily accessible to all members. As a consequence, we'll be able to call up a bill which will be displayed in its current engrossed version, determine its status as of that moment, and call up any related bill or provision of existing law for comparative purposes. Of course, if we want to print out, and you have that here too, of any display, we have access to high-speed printers, which will get that job done. We believe that OLIS has demonstrated that computer technology can do more for a legislature than process numbers. OLIS provides fast and accurate information to members and the public. The printing function of the system, which is the only one of its type in the country, has allowed us to meet the rigorous printing schedules of the legislature at a time when the volume of material which gets printed is expanding rapidly. You'll recall the figure, 2,449 bills, all printed. You can understand then with the amendments that come flying through, and all the rest of the printing that's done, what a strain it is on a normal printing process. At the same time, we have been able to expand the information contained in such publications as the calendar and make them more useful to the members and the public. I want to turn your attention now to Oregon's solution to what's called the no-fault insurance law, and I understand that there's been some movement within the legislature to do something along that line. As you develop your own system, and I don't know how badly you need it because you don't have very many roads and relatively few number of vehicles, but if you find in your judgment that you do need such a system, I would highly recommend, again, the Oregon plan as a model. Unlike the experience of many states who have experimented with this type of legislation with a pure or a just slightly modified no-fault auto insurance plans, our experience has been excellent. It has satisfied consumers, attorneys, and the insurance industry. That's a big three-way parlay. If you can make the attorneys and the consumers and the industry itself happy. Premium costs for personal injury protection have gone up during our four-year experience, but the rate of increase has been significantly less than the rate of inflation generally. At the same time, we have by legislative action increased benefits under the plan. Our law, which was effective on January 1, 1972, mandates that each motor vehicle liability policy issued for delivery in Oregon shall provide coverage for the named insured and family members of the same household injured in an automobile accident, passengers injured in the insured vehicle, and pedestrians injured by the insured vehicle are also covered. The 1971 coverage benefits have been updated by the legislature at our 1973 and 75 sessions to the following level of benefits. First, $5,000 for all reasonable medical and related expenses incurred within 1 year of the accident. Second, $1,000 for all reasonable funeral and related expenses incurred within 1 year of the accident. Third, $9,000 for 70% of income loss from a remunerative occupation if disabled for 14 days. Such benefits may be limited to $750 a month for 52 weeks. And fourth, $6,552 for persons not usually engaged in a remunerative occupation for essential service expenses reasonably incurred in lieu of services the beneficiary would have performed without income during the disability period. Such benefits may be limited to $18 a day for 52 weeks. Studies by our Department of Transportation indicate that these benefits contain almost 95% of the economic loss for all auto victims in the state of Oregon. The success of our plan is largely attributable to prompt payment of medical bills and disability income and the excellent job it does of answering the problem of small or frivolous lawsuits. While injured parties are still free to make a tort claim for bodily injury, the law requires that they reimburse their carrier fully from any proceeds before either the injured party or his attorney receive anything. Nice little hook. Consequently, a potential tort claim must have real value before it merits attention. A survey by our insurance commissioner revealed that during the first 3 years of operation, there was a 33.4% reduction in the frequency of bodily injury claims. This decline should be compared with a population growth of 8.3% and a 16% increase in auto registration for the same period. The Oregon plan is people-oriented and takes no rights away from the people, whether they're rich or whether they're poor. It does not set up an artificial barrier which the injured party must achieve before he can ask for redress against the person who injured him. I assume that you are perhaps going through the same intensive lobbying efforts from all sides that we experienced in 1971 and 73 as we developed and improved our plan. Again, we feel that our plan has been quite successful and fairly protects both the injured party and all people that are involved in the accident. I firmly believe that the no-fault experience demonstrates once again that the states are better able to solve their problems than Congress. I encourage you to work diligently to develop an Alaska plan that meets your needs and to work against any federal plan which cannot help but create more problems than it solves. As our insurance commissioner recently said, the enactment of either of the two principal federal bills on no fault would be based on as great a misrepresentation of the facts by the proponents as was the Tonkin Gulf resolution. Strong words, but he means it, and he has the data to show, to prove that that's true. I'd like to close today by making some comments on the emergence of state legislatures. I, for one, am proud, as I know every one of you are, to be a part of a strong and a responsive branch of government in our states. During this past session, we were continually reminded of the insensitivity and the unworkability of federal laws and regulations. Laws and regulations which frequently prevented us from effectively addressing the needs of the citizens of Oregon in a responsible fashion. I believe that our country's future rests not in the hands of Washington, but in the state houses of our 50 great states. I see the pendulum swinging. For 200 years, the pendulum has been swinging from the concept of our founding fathers, where the states were the preeminent force, that the federal government was a creature of the states, and the states were not creatures of the federal government. For 200 years, that pendulum has been swinging towards more and more power to the federal government and away from the states. In my capacity as a member of the executive board of the National Conference of State Legislatures, I have been greatly benefited by the contacts that I have had with legislative leaders such as your own and the rest of the states over this last year. And I believe that I feel and I see that pendulum swinging back. I happen to believe that almost all politics, public life, is cyclical in nature. It doesn't run on a linear basis, up or down. I think it tends to repeat itself. History tends to repeat itself as a cliche, but I believe that it does. And I think that we are seeing for the first time some remarkable things happening in Washington as they begin to realize that they cannot legislate. In one piece of legislation, they cannot legislate fairly for Florida, for New York, or for Oregon or Alaska, or any of the states in between. And so they are going to, by the very force of the problems and the immediacy of the need for solution, send those problems back to the states for their solution. I see this happening, and I see the need for our legislatures, all of them, to gear up to be able to have the mechanism and the mechanics to meet the challenge that's coming. While there are certainly areas of true national interest which can only adequately be addressed by the Congress, the time has come for the states to reassert their right to deal with the problems of their citizens in a responsible fashion. I noted with interest the broadcast interviews with citizens of Massachusetts earlier this week after their primary. Almost without exception, the people feel that the only time elected officials really care about them is during an election campaign. I don't believe that we would find Oregonians generally as cynical as that, at least with regard to state government. As we have opened our doors and reached out to them and improved our own processes, we have found a dramatic increase in citizen participation in the legislative process. People turn to us with their problems in ever-increasing numbers. We are visible, and I think generally we are trusted. As the public's participation increases, so does our ability to meet their needs, as we are better informed about those needs. And finally, I would commend to you a device that we used during the interim of 1973-75 to implement many of our ideas for the improvement of the legislative process. The Speaker and I appointed a broadly based committee of approximately 50 people. Involved in this committee were legislators, citizens, media representatives, technical experts, editorial writers, reporters, all to evaluate these ideas that they would come up with for the improvement of the process. The result was immediate implementation of many programs, such as the LAMP program and the OLIS program. These programs met with public acceptance, and there was no partisan hassle over these programs because the public and the political parties were deeply involved in their development as they came along. And so even though some of these programs were expensive, as things as expenses go for state legislatures, there was no partisan nitpicking back and forth on these things. None at all, because we had taken care of that during this process of these public hearings, which were widely reported in the paper, widely quoted in the editorial columns, widely commented upon by the newspaper and radio editorial speakers. As a consequence, we were able to implement these programs with absolutely no hassle on the part of the public or on the part of the political parties. Our current capital expansion, which 5 years ago would have been a tremendously divisive issue in the state of Oregon, can be traced back in part to the work of the Legislative Improvements Committee. As they got into the Capitol and saw what the legislature was dealing with, the inadequacy of the hearing rooms, the inadequacy of the facilities for the public to come and view the legislature, as they saw these things, they talked about them in the media that they represented and to their constituents. As a consequence, this broad public support has built up to the point that we were able to pass the appropriation bill for this with an absolute minimum of controversy. Not that everybody agreed with it, but there was a minimum of controversy, and nobody disputed the facts of the need. It was mostly a dispute on the timing. Well, this type of legislative improvements committee did work well for us. I'm confident that it could work well for you if you haven't maybe already done it. I would highly commend it to you. Well, Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, thank you again for the opportunity of addressing you here today. I hope to meet and visit with many of you personally this afternoon and tomorrow until I return to my home on Sunday. And I'm sure that you all know that you're welcome, contrary to our former governor's loudmouth blasts, the people not being welcome in Oregon. We're under new management in the state of Oregon now. And you, your friends, and your relatives, we'd love to have you come. If you'd let me know, I'd be happy to make the facilities of the Capitol available for you and give you all the assistance and aid that we can in helping you as you develop your legislative process. You have a great opportunity. You're a young state. You have a tremendous, tremendous opportunity to advance the cause of the state legislatures, not only here in Alaska, but as a model for the entire nation to go by. I'm confident you are embarked on that type of a program, that you will continue it, and we wish you all the success in the world. Thank you.
Ask unanimous consent to joint session adjourned. Without objection, we're adjourned.
Okay. House come to order. Mr. Miller.
Speaker, I'll move and ask unanimous consent this body stand in recess until 1:15.
Without objection, when recessed to 1:15. House come to order. Under debate before the House was committee substitute for House Bill 572, which was in third reading. Mr. Speckin. You may, sir. Without objection, so ordered. Mr. Miller.
Speaker, as long as excuse my calls are up for the moment, I'll make place a couple of motions myself. Representative Wallace has asked to be excused, and I move that he be excused from the call on the 11th and 12th. And the 17th through the 19th, Representative Brown has requested his earlier excuse the call can be negated. He's not going to have to leave after all. But he has requested to be excused from noon on the Friday the 12th through plain time on Monday.
Mr. Swanson. Without objection, excuse will be noted. Mr. Cotton.
This is a procedural matter, then I'll ask to be excused from 2 o'clock today until Monday morning.
Without objection. Now, are we discussing the bill yet, or are there other matters come before the body? Do you wish to discuss the bill, Mr. Urien, or do you have other matters?
Well, I'd want to do that, but I want to excuse myself also, if I may, Mr.
Gladly.
Speaker, from about 4.
From what time?
Was that
Mr.
from 4 o'clock today to the end of the session, or
Representative
from 4 Vito. O'clock today till Monday morning?
I didn't hear any objection. So, Representative Eder.
Yeah, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to be excused starting 2 o'clock today, just today. I've scheduled hearings, the House Finance Subcommittee on Health and Social Services, and the topic will be on Alcantara. And we have some people that are here out of town, and I had scheduled it about a week ago, so I'd like to be excused starting at 2.
I'm sure, Representative Eder, you can be excused, but we cannot excuse anybody from the call as long as they're in Juneau, even if they're sick.
Yes, I'll be on first floor in this building.
Very well. Representative Rudd.
Mr. Speaker, may I introduce a guest?
You may have the floor for introduction.
In Gallery A is a good friend of mine, a woman who with her husband opened their home to me when I came to Juneau, and who is the former chair of the Alaska Commission on the Status of Women, Isabel McLean. Sorry, she's in Gallery B.
Very well. Now, are there other matters to come before the House? Mr. Swanson. Very well. If there's no other matters to come before the House, then we're back to committee substitute for House Bill 570. Is there discussion? Mr. Hackney.
Mr. Speaker, I think we've established that this is a report requirement on a problem that probably doesn't exist in Alaska. To be made on a form that no one's going to look at, and to be filed in some bureaucratic dustbin. So I suggest, Mr. Speaker, that we again provide a good laugh for the taxpayers of the state of Alaska and some more fodder for the editorial writers by proceeding to vote on this bill.
You're in rare form, Mr. Hackney. Are there other aspects of debate? question is, the committee substitute for House Bill 572 passed the House. The members may proceed to vote. Has any member failed to vote? Clerk may close the roll. Does any member wish to change their vote? Clerk may take the roll.
Twenty-one yeas, 11 nays, 8 excused.
A squeaker. Committee substitute has passed the House. We will have to have, it does have an effective date, and we will have to have a, it's no effective date.
On the committee substitute.
We will have to have a separate roll call on the effective date because we did not have the necessary 27 votes. Question is, shall the effective date pass the House? Members may proceed to vote. Does any member fail to vote? Clerk may close the roll. Does any member wish to change their vote? Clerk may take the roll.
31 yeas, 2 nays, 7 excused.
The bill has passed the House. The effective date has also been adopted. Clerk, read the next item on the calendar.
House Bill number 723 by Parker, an act relating to the residential homestead exemption. The Committee on Judiciary has had House Bill 723 under consideration. A majority of the members of the committee recommends it do pass. The report was signed by Mr. Gardner, Chairman, concurred in by Gardner, Brown, Cotton, Bradley, Specking, Eliason, and Parr. I have no amendments on my desk, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Miller.
Speaker, if there are no amendments, I'll move and ask unanimous consent that House Bill 723 be considered engrossed, advanced to third reading, and placed on final passage.
Hearing no objection, House Bill 723 is advanced from second to third reading, placed on final passage. The clerk read the bill for the third and final time.
House Bill number 723 by Parker, an act relating to the residential homestead exemption.
Bills before you for discussion and debate. Question is, shall House Bill 723 pass the House? The members may proceed to vote. Any member failed to vote, the clerk may take the roll. Does any member wish to change their vote? Clerk may take the roll.
33 yeas, no nays, 7 excused.
House Bill 723 has passed the House. This brings us to the end of the regular calendar to unfinished business. Is there anything to come before the House in unfinished business? Mr. Uria. House may stand at ease. House come to order. Is there other matters to come before the House? Mr. Urian.
Mr. Speaker, I move and ask unanimous consent that my reconsideration on committee substitute for House Bill 584 be held over till Monday.
That's the pharmaceutical drug bill.
Yes.
Hearing no objection, committee substitute for House Bill 584 will be held over under reconsideration until Monday. Is there anything more to come before the House under unfinished business? Special orders. Committee announcements. Mr. Anderson.
I just would like to serve most of the consideration of my vote on committee substitute for House Bill number 573.
Without objection, your reconsideration is noted.
Mr. Speaker, the committee of the time of adjournment, the House Resources Committee will meet two bills, House Bill number 7698, the block grants.
Mr. Cotton.
Mr. Speaker, Community and Regional Affairs will meet Monday morning at 9. Two bills on the calendar, House Bill 478 dealing with municipal wage tax and repealing Alaska business license tax, House Bill 490 authorizing borough tax on net income.
Mr. Gardner.
Judiciary is going to meet immediately upon adjournment. Hopefully, everybody will get there so we can be done by 3 and go watch some movies. We're going to have up House Bill 677, which is antitrust laws applies to banking, and Senate Bill 336, 345, 346 on alcoholism and driving, and Senate Bill 511, enforcement of revenue laws. And also, Speaker, I've placed on everybody's desk except the members of the Judiciary Committee, which already had this information, a packet of information from all sides and just general information on the Cook Inlet land trade, since that is scheduled for next Monday. And also, I might announce that Senator Poland's committee is going to be meeting at 2:30 p.m. on in Courtroom A of the new court building, and they're I think they're going to try and have somebody down from the Joint Federal State Land Use Planning Commission to speak to them, and anybody that she's asked me to extend the invitation, any House members that wish to be there to listen to that. That's on Sunday at 2:30 p.m. in the Courtroom A of the court building across the street.
Mr. Brown.
This is not quite in the nature of a committee announcement, but I would like the members of the Select Committee on Telecommunications to each one of them just stop and have a word with me sometime after the session today.
Mr. Wallace. Mr. Osterbeck.
House has will meet at 3 p.m. today to take up Senate Bill 272, an act relating to food service and stands by blind and handicapped people, and Senate Bill 203, an act relating to school attendance. House Bill 724, an act relating to blind and handicapped persons.
Mr. Bradley.
Ms. Speaker, House Commerce, Monday morning at 8 a.m., will be taking up two bills by Duncan dealing with tourism, House Bill 730 and 731, and a Senate bill dealing with tourism, Senate Bill 436.
Mr. Malone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The House Finance Committee will be meeting at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. On a complete list of the bills. Two of them are House Bill 624 and 625, dealing with the planning revolving fund, Department of Public Works. The rest of the bills will be posted on the board. We'll also be meeting at 8:30 a.m. Monday morning, taking up House Bill 583, the bill revising the date of collection of taxes on the oil and gas exploration and transportation property. House Bill 695, an appropriation to the Department of Highways, and House Bill 619 and 620, general obligation bonds for rural school construction. Like the members of the committee to be advised, the committee will meet immediately on adjournment of this session today for a short meeting in House Finance. Item on the agenda is House Joint Resolution 57. I believe that's the number. Dealing with federal harbor appropriations.
Before adjournment, Representative Gardner indicated we have tentatively scheduled the Cook Inlet land trade for Monday. That date is relatively close to the final day in which the legislature has, and essentially to approve or disprove that particular transaction. And it probably will result in having to deal with that bill substantially in one day. The point I'm getting at is that I think the chair would have to consider it not a discourtesy, since we're under such a time crunch, and that delay also has been an attempt to accommodate those people who have concerns and want to participate in the land use planning deliberations and so on going on in Anchorage at this time, that it probably would not be considered a discourtesy to take it up and reconsider it in the same day. We do have until Thursday to get that to the opposite body. The timetable is such that if we do deliver it on Monday and they can read it then, everything's fine. But there's much delay after that. You get into a somewhat precarious situation. A course, the burden is not necessarily completely on the House because the opposite body has free license to introduce and approve and do anything on such legislation. They could have brought it over here 30 days ago. But in our discussions with them, that's about the timing frame that does appear to exist. And I just want the House to be advised of that situation on Monday, to be as prepared as possible to debate the bill fully that day so nobody feels hard-pressed to give up their right of reconsideration. Mr. Miller.
Speaker, one further announcement I know I'm looking forward to, and I'm sure other members of this body also are looking forward to, the Filipino folk dance performance. It'll be tonight and tomorrow night at J.D. High School. Representing Buckhold, of course, has got a large share of that activity, and we're looking forward to it. Speaker, if there's no further announcements to come before the body, I'll move and ask unanimous consent. We stand in adjournment until 10 a.m. Monday morning.
That objection, we're in adjournment.